think that's all the electronics. I think. No promises. Thank you all again for this week. I've been looking forward to this for months. I see the Drydens throughout the year, and John and I serve at a summer camp together, and love the time that I get to spend with him, love his family. We're so excited for Jack's wedding yesterday, and thrilled about that, and them starting their new life together. Excited for y'all. Thank you for everyone who's visiting. Whether you knew the meeting was happening or not, thank you for being here. And for the congregation here, thank you for the sacrifice that you're making and trying to provide this to the community in the area. I know several friends over the next couple of nights that are making plans to be here and worshiping with us and studying with us. And so I'm excited about that. We're going to continue our study in the life of Moses and move forward in Exodus chapter 2. Really, what we looked at this morning was the historical context, the political context surrounding the time of Moses' birth. And we got up to his birth, but that was about it. And now we're going to pick up in chapter 2 around verse 11. And the way Exodus handles the life of Moses is it skips big chunks of time. It just does. And that's appropriate. You've got a man that's going to live 120 years. He's going to do a lot in 120 years. Moses, we believe, is the one who recorded the Exodus, and it has a very specific focus. And the focus of that book is to get the people out of Egypt. So what we're going to do is we're going to pick up in verse 11, and let's get this going. And talk about the prince's humility. The goal of this lesson is to look at his childhood, his early adulthood, but then look at the incident that led to him fleeing Egypt at about 40 years old. And this is a large swath of time, but let's start reading in verse 11, okay? One day, when Moses had grown up, he went out to his people and looked on their burdens, and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his people. He looked this way and that, and seeing no one, he struck down the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. Let's just stop there for a second. There's a whole lot that Moses expects us to understand and assume, okay? Because the first half of the chapter, he was conceived and he was born, and you've got the first 3 months of life, and you've got his mother nursing him, and then she turns him over to Pharaoh's family to raise. And then you've got 38, 39 years before the next incident in his life. But there have been some foundational moments. I mean, Moses was a person of two worlds. He knew who he was. He knew his family. He knew his parents. He knew his sister. He knew that he came from a subjected people. He knew all of that. And I can only assume the teaching and the talks that his parents must have had over him when he was a child before they turned him over. Trying to explain how much they loved him, how much they cared for him. I'm sure he grew up knowing about the circumstances of his birth and his rescue. I mean, imagine being one of a generation that survived. I mean, have you ever visited someplace, this happens in congregations sometimes, where you go into a local congregation and there are segments of age that are just missing? And that was Moses, where there was a segment of his generation that was just gone, and he was the only one, and he knew how God had delivered him. But then you go to the oppressor's house, and you grow up in the oppressor's house. But the oppressor has a really nice house. And you benefit from that. You benefit from the education. You benefit with the clothing. You benefit with the modes of transportation. And the way the pharaohs worked is they claimed the status of deity. And so if Moses had continued, there would have been this perception of him, this role that he would have been expected to step into at some point. But he knows that that's not consistent with who he is and what he knows. And so he's a man of two worlds. He's split. But what we see in 11 and 12 is that he's been living in tension. And his comprehension of what's right and what's wrong, he's been stewing on it for a while and realizing something needed to be done. And so when you get to verse 11 and you kick off with one day, like things are about to change. The status quo is going to be rejected. One day, when Moses had grown up, he's 40. There's all this emphasis in the text on belonging. He went out to his people. He's identifying with them. He went out to his people. And he looked on their burdens. That's a word from chapter 1. He's looking at them and he's just like, man, this is not fair. Their life is so hard. This is not right. Look at what they're having to do. And as he looks at that and he thinks about the unfairness of all of that, he sees an Egyptian just wailing on one of his people. And he's done. He's just done. And he looked this way and that, and seeing no one, he struck down the Egyptian and hit him in the sand. He defends the life of the Hebrew by taking the life of the Egyptian. Now, there is so much more to this moment, and you get into Moses' mindset. If you go over to Acts chapter 7, Acts chapter 7, in Stephen's speech, this is one of the what you would call a deacon. He's not specifically called a deacon, but he's serving in the church in Jerusalem. He's one of the ones that has been selected by the church to serve the Grecian widows. In Acts chapter 7, he is giving a defense for Christianity to the Jews, and he's giving specifically a defense for God and God being with his people all over the place, not just in Jerusalem. And he actually goes back to Egypt and talks about Moses. So if you go back to verse 20 of Acts 7, at this time, he's doing his history lesson. At this time, Moses was born, and he was beautiful in God's sight. Like, that's mentioned everywhere. It's mentioned in Acts 7. It's mentioned in Hebrews 11. It's mentioned back in Exodus. He was beautiful in God's sight, and he was brought up for 3 months in his father's house. And when he was exposed, the idea was put into the river to die. When he was exposed, Pharaoh's daughter adopted him and brought him up as her own son. And Moses was instructed in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, and he was mighty in words and deeds. He was an influential guy. Verse 23, when he was 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brothers, the children of Israel. So he's improving, he's growing, more influential, but I want to see my people. So he goes, in verse 24, seeing one of them being wronged, he defended the oppressed man. So like what Moses did was not an act of rage. It wasn't an act of passion. He was defending someone who was being oppressed. He avenged him, not revenged him. He avenged him by striking down the Egyptian. And verse 25 is critical. He supposed that his brothers would understand that God was giving them salvation by his hand, but they did not understand. One of the things that Stephen is trying to do in his speech is to say, hey, God was with his people all over the place, all over the world, not just here in Jerusalem. And God sends people to help his people all the time, and they reject them all the time. And so he uses Moses, and he says, look, Moses... We get insight into his mindset. Moses thought, I'm going to save them now. It's time. I'm going to save them. And so when you go back to Exodus chapter 2, and Moses goes out that day to see his people, to visit his people, to see his brothers, and he sees one getting struck down, he's like, this is the catalyst. This is the moment I've been waiting for. I think God has been preparing me to deliver them. I think something was special about my birth and being drawn out. I think there's a reason God's allowed me to grow up with all this privilege and influence. I think, And today's the day. And so his plan was to reveal himself to his people, and he steps up and intervenes for his people. That's what's going on. Verse 13, when he went out the next day, I mean, if you were Moses and you understand his mindset, what kind of reception do you think you're going to get when you walk back into the people? He's here. Oh, it's Moses. Thank you, man. Let's go. We're going to storm the Capitol. Like, whatever. He thought it was going to be a favorable response. When he went out the next day, behold, two Hebrews were struggling together. So Hebrew and a Hebrew. And he said to the man in the wrong, why do you strike your companion? And he answered, who made you a prince and a judge over us? Do you mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian? Like, that's not what he expected. It's not what he expected. And you hear that, like that tone of voice, you hear that all the time if you've got kids. If somebody's wrestling and they're arguing and one of the kids tries to intervene, the other kids are like, who are you? Actually, what they say is, you're not my mom. You're not my dad. I don't have to listen to you. And they question authority. They're questioning the authority, like the chain of command, right? Moses is stepping in, assuming that they would recognize something about him. They'd be like, oh yeah, that's the guy. That's the guy that God has taken care of for the last four decades. That's the guy who intervened and saved, you know, whatever his name is yesterday. That's the guy. And they would stop. But instead they get snotty and say, oh, are you going to kill us too? And then Moses was afraid and thought, surely the thing is known. When Pharaoh heard of it, he sought to kill Moses. But Moses fled from Pharaoh and stayed in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. Now the priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came and drew water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. The shepherds came and drove them away, but Moses stood up and saved them and watered their flock. And when they came home to their father, Reuel, he said, how is it that you've come home so soon today? And they said, an Egyptian. They don't know any better. I mean, Moses has been raised an Egyptian, dressed like an Egyptian, walks like an Egyptian. An Egyptian delivered us out of the hands of the shepherds and even drew water for us and watered the flock. And he said to his daughters, where is he? Why have you left the man? Call him that he may eat bread. And Moses was content to dwell with the man, and he gave Moses his daughter Zipporah. And she gave birth to a son, and he called his name Gershom, for he said, I have been a sojourner in a foreign land. I just let you know, I love that phrase because it connects him to all of the other patriarchs. It connects him to all of them. You know, when Jacob finally gets into Israel through Joseph's deliverance, and Jacob gets there, and Pharaoh's like, so who are you and how old are you? And he says, the years of my sojourning have been. And he's like, where I'm living right now is not home, and where I was living last time was not home. Like, I'm one of God's, and I'm sojourning. Like, I love that phrase. And so to hear these Israelites attached to that phrase, I'm a sojourner. Guess what, Christians? We're a sojourner. Like, I love that phrase. So let's look at some of this. This is another map. We showed one in the Bible class session. This is another potential map of the route of the Exodus. If you're following the red dashed line, okay? But the one that we want to pay attention to this morning is the darker dashed line that shows the caravan route from Egypt to Arabia. Because the odds are it was somewhere along that route that Moses traveled when he fled from Egypt to Midian. It was the main highway, and he was trying to get gone as fast as he could. So the odds are that's probably where he went until he settled somewhere on the other side of the Gulf of Aqaba in the land of Midian. Just take a look at that for a second. And then let's make some points as we go, okay? One of the things that we made the point of in the Bible class session is really Exodus chapter 1 and the first half of chapter 2 better describe the faith of Moses' parents. Moses had nothing to do with the decisions that were being made. Really, chapter 1 had to do with the faith of the midwives, And the first 10 verses of chapter 2 was the faith of Moses' parents. They evaluated the risks. They're the ones that valued life. They're the ones that made decisions for Moses. He wasn't capable of making decisions. But by the time we get to chapter 2, verse 11, Moses is a grown man and he is making choices for himself. And so let's talk through his choices. Let's talk about verse 11. The first thing that's significant to me is in verse 11, when Moses had grown up, he went out to his people and he looked on their burdens. Similar statement over in Acts chapter 7. He went out to visit his brothers, and then he saw the one being oppressed, is the word. Okay? You don't step in to help until you realize there's a need. And Moses was aware of the need. I mean, he'd been hearing about it. He'd been seeing it with his personal family. He knew what he had escaped. He knew the circumstances. But then that day he went out and he saw something that was just above and beyond the average. And it just multiplied in his mind. There's a burden here. There's a burden here. And that burden needs to be lifted. It needs to be lessened. And then go over to Hebrews chapter 11. Go over to Hebrews 11. And let's look at some of his thought process as he made some of these other choices. I mean, we know what he did. He intervened. He hid the body. He went back the next day and tried to really judge between two. The thing became known, and then he ran. But why did he do all of that? In chapter 11, starting at about verse 23, by faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents because they saw that the child was beautiful and they were not afraid of the king's edict. By faith, Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to be mistreated with the people of God than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He considered the reproach of Christ greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. By faith he left Egypt, not being afraid of the anger of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. By faith he kept the Passover and sprinkled the blood so that the destroyer of the firstborn might not touch them. And then when you get to verse 29, it's the people of Israel. By faith, the people crossed the Red Sea as on dry land, but the Egyptians, when they attempted to do the same, were drowned. Go back to verse 24. When you get to the point of Moses making a decision, by faith, Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He knows something. He knows when he makes that decision to intervene, he's made a choice. You know, he's grown up with a foot in both worlds. He's straddling the fence. He knows at some point he's going to have to commit, and that day was the commitment. He knew, I've crossed a line, and with this decision, when this decision becomes known to the king, things are going to change, but I'm willing to do that, okay? So he knew he was doing something, but he's having to weigh out what are the pros and what are the cons. It's really easy to focus on the cons. Well, there goes the nice house, and there goes the nice food, and there goes the nice clothes. And if I'm choosing to identify with my people, that actually means my burdens increase. They have the potential for increasing really quick. That means a harder life. But what are the pros? And he's saying he wants to be associated with God's people. He doesn't want to identify as pharaohs anymore. He wants to identify as gods. And so what you end up seeing is he rejects the worldly, the earthly advantages that he had. Verse 24, when it says he refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, it's talking about the advantage that came with being in Pharaoh's household. He rejected that. Whatever advantage came with that, whatever that looked like, whatever those details are, he gave those up. Not only that, in verse 25, he chose to be mistreated with the people of God rather than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. something that went along with Pharaoh's household was some sinful stuff. Like, you can go and look through history books about what the culture of Pharaoh's household was like and the immorality that went along with Egyptian living. He had been exposed to all of that. We don't know how much he had participated in all of that. We don't know. We just know that he knew of it. He was aware of it. He could have. But by identifying with God's people, he's saying, no, I'm not pursuing that. I'm giving up the fleeting pleasures of sin. Whatever those pleasures are, he understands they're temporary. They don't last. They're no benefit to an eternal life. And so he rejects the temporary pleasures that come with being a part of Pharaoh's household. Instead, he's swapping the fleeting pleasures of sin for mistreatment with the people of God. Another way of saying that, I think, is amplified in verse 26. He considered the reproach of Christ greater wealth. How does he know Jesus? The reproach of Christ. How does he know Jesus? You know, I think what is being hinted at here, and all through Hebrews 11, is that these people of the Old Testament, as they choose God and the promises that they're aware of, because think about it, we're in the second book of the Bible, Exodus. There's a whole lot that has not been revealed, but the little bit that he does know is attached to all the promises and all the prophecies that are going to be fulfilled in Christ. So by choosing faith in God, he's choosing Christ. He doesn't know that, but we can look at it and go, oh man, yeah. And he ends up choosing humiliation. I'm not going to put any titles out there, but you know, there are several every generation. You know, the movies or the sitcoms, you pick. And the general plot is, especially in the teen years, or it's a high school drama or whatever, you've got the popular kids, and you've got the, you know, the shy wallflower that comes in, and they want to belong to the popular kids so they don't get beat up, but they really want to be popular. But they're kind of friends with the nerdy outcasts, and by the culmination of the movie, they're having to choose. You know, do I stay with the popular kids and the nice hair that they've given me and the clothes and the status, or do I sacrifice all that and be true to the nerdy kids? You know, that's a recurring plot. Actually, some people live through that. They live through that. And the movies are always like, you get both. Oh, that is not real. Not real. Okay. Moses is doing that times infinity, where all the popular, cool, influential people from Pharaoh's household are over here, and he's choosing to associate with the subjected people, which means I'm choosing subjection. Now, what he didn't know was how much he would be subjected. Okay? When you put all the pieces together between Exodus 2, Acts 7, and Hebrews 11, and you get into Moses' mind, he thought he was going to be the deliverer. He was right, just at the wrong time. And it was going to look way different. He thought, man, I'm going to come in and with all my political clout and networking and blah, 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 I'm going to convince dad and everybody to, or grandfather to release everybody. Like, he thought he had it worked out. And that's not what happened. He got rejected by his own people and had to flee for his life and end up taking care of animals in a dusty desert for 40 years. I don't know many people that write that down in school as their aspiration for work. What do you see yourself doing in 15 years? You know, scooping up stuff of donkeys and, you know, animals and chasing down dumb little things that won't stay in their pen and, you know, throwing them on my shoulder. And yeah, that's what I want to do. Said no prince of Egypt ever. Like, being a shepherd was a derogatory, demeaning thing. And Moses has been exposed to the shame of that. And that's what he ends up doing. And what Exodus chapter 2 says is he was content to do it. and then we skip forward another 40 years. But there's something important about this. I think as you read the text, what's being implied is God is preparing Moses. God's preparing Moses. He doesn't need a prince of Egypt to lead his people out. He needs a shepherd to lead his people out. He doesn't need someone with political connections. He needs somebody with the patience to put up with stubborn people and still do what's in their best interest, even though it's going to wear him threadbare. Moses was right in that God was going to use him, but God wasn't done preparing him for it. He'd prepared Moses to the point that he had the courage to make the right choice, but he wasn't ready to shepherd the people. And there's something else interesting in this, and I think it's important to connect. It's mentioned in all of these passages, Hebrews 11, Acts 7, and then Exodus 2. If you go back to Exodus 2, he realizes the thing is known. Like Pharaoh has become aware, I killed a guy. I killed an Egyptian. And it says he was afraid. But then when you go to Acts 7, Stephen says, and he was not afraid. And then Hebrews 11, he was not afraid. Verse 27, by faith he left Egypt, not being afraid of the anger of the king. Is the Bible contradicting itself? Because Exodus 2 clearly says he was afraid. And I think there's something really important to be said here. Think about something that you may be scared of. I made an evangelistic trip to the Philippines when I was in my 20s, and I went with a group of people, and we were sailing from the main island to a smaller island, and we were going to spend a couple of days there and then sail back, and so we had to get on a ferry. And like I love water, and I love ferries. We had them where I grew up in the Pacific Northwest. You know, where Anna and I honeymooned, we had to ride a ferry each way. We went there when we first got married and went back at our 15-year anniversary. But not everybody likes water like that. There was one girl that went with us on the Philippines, and she was hugging the pillar on the inside of the deck, and she would not let go. She was terrified. And she was focusing so hard, like she was sweating, and it wasn't from the heat. And I had a little tiny iPod shuffle at the time, because that's what was out. And I was like, do you need some distraction? She's like, yes, yes. And so she hugged that pillar, listening to my iPod shuffle the whole way there and the whole way back. Maybe it's not water for you. Maybe it's heights. I tell you, I'm not a fan of heights. I'm not. I mean, you may look at those pictures. We went up to the top of Mount Sinai. Man, I was sweating, and it wasn't from heat. This is the point. Is it normal to be afraid when you realize you've done something that someone might kill you for? Yes. But did he let that fear keep him from making the decision? No. My friend who was going over to help work with the young ladies and the women in the Philippines with the gospel, was she terrified of getting on the ferry? Yes. But what did she do? She got on the ferry. Twice. Am I particularly fond of heights? No. But tens of thousands of miles in the plane every year. And I think this is the point. He didn't let fear control him. He was afraid, and it was a natural fear. It was right to be fearful. But he didn't allow his fear to keep him from doing what he knew God wanted him to do. There's a difference between the two. Okay? So it was normal to be like, oh man, Pharaoh's angry with me and I just killed one of his guys and he's going to come after me. That's a normal thing. But he didn't run away out of terror. He ran toward where he needed to go. He didn't let fear control him. He didn't let fear control the choice. There's a similar passage. Maybe we can make a great application here. Look at 1 Peter chapter 3. You might think, well, that's kind of weird. 1 Peter 3 is talking about marriage. Yes, it is. The first six verses of 1 Peter 3 are talking to wives. Verse 7 is talking to the husband. And in the context of 1 Peter 3, Peter is writing to a lady who's married to someone who is not a Christian. And when you understand what the Bible has to say about the roles of marriage, that wives are supposed to submit to their husbands, that's part of what Peter is teaching here, that is a terrifying thing. That can be a terrifying thing. That you're going to put yourself in a relationship where you're expected to be submissive to somebody, but the risk is this person going to be a good head of the family or not? As he practices his headship, how is he going to practice it? Is he going to be a dictator or is he going to be a servant leader? What is he going to be? Like, that's scary. Look at verse 6. What Peter says as he explains Sarah, that Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, and you ladies are her children if you do good and do not fear anything that is frightening. Well, if it's frightening, shouldn't I be afraid? Yes, but I don't think on the surface that's what he's talking about. He's saying, let's acknowledge that that's scary, but don't let that fear paralyze you. Keep doing what you're supposed to do. It doesn't mean it's not fearful. He's not saying to bury that and not acknowledge that it's scary. It's scary. Okay, look, I appreciate more and more my father-in-law when I propose to Anna. And he's like, but it's you. Like, I don't know if I want to give my daughter to you. I respect that. I've got two girls, and I'm like, I don't know who I would give them to. Or trust them with. That's a big thing, and guys need to be thinking about that. Are we going to make ourselves trustworthy of that? But that's what Moses did. It was natural for him to be afraid, but he did not let his fear paralyze him. Going back to Hebrews 11, and looking at verse 27, by faith he left Egypt, not being afraid of the anger of the king, for he endured. He endured as seeing him who is invisible. There's this great statement that faith lives in the tension between promise and fulfillment. Faith lives in the tension between promise and fulfillment. God says he's going to do something, and that's the promise. He doesn't always tell us when. Sometimes he'll give us some information on the how, but not all of it. And then we have to live in between the two. And faith lives there. And sometimes that period is shorter, sometimes it's longer. Think about Israel. They go into Egypt and they're free. But they have to live there and go through subjugation for centuries before God leads them out. They don't know how long that period was going to be. And Moses was looking at it going, hey, I think I'm the marker of the end. And then he got really disappointed. He was right. He was just 40 years off. And so faith endures. But in order to do that, you have to humble yourself and realize that there are things about your life you don't get to control. God's the one who's in control. The would-be leader of Israel had to learn to shepherd stubborn animals and wait on God for 40 more years. And then when you go back to Exodus chapter 2, verses 12 through 15, what you see is that he was rejected. He thought he'd be accepted. He thought he would be celebrated. He wasn't. He was rejected by his own. So guess where all that is going? Remember, God said he was going to raise someone up like Moses from among your brothers, and you should listen to him. Jesus saw our burdens. He realizes that we are heavy laden. He invites us to come to him and find rest, to take his yoke upon us and find rest for our souls. You who are weary and heavy laden, Jesus sees our burdens. Whatever those are, whether it's from the burden of sin or whether it's the burden of living in a sin-cursed world, both of those are burdens, but Jesus sees that. He's compassionate. I mean, how many times did he look out and see people and he's like, oh man, and he had so much compassion for them. They're like sheep without a shepherd. The fields are white unto harvest. And he would try to get his disciples to see people and their needs. Jesus saw our burdens. When you go to Philippians chapter 2, the first third of that chapter, what Paul is really trying to emphasize down through there is the humility of Jesus and his willingness to reject advantage and take on the form of a servant, to take on human flesh. Really, that's what that's emphasizing there. Let's look at a particular phrase. Philippians 2. Verse 5, have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus, who though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but made himself nothing. Some of your versions will say he emptied himself, taking the form of a servant. Let's stop right there. I don't want to get super technical, but I think it's helpful to think through because this has, you know, made some people struggle over the years. When it says he emptied himself or he made himself nothing in verse 7, what did he empty himself of? And there's some people that have reached some really interesting and I think incorrect conclusions about that. I think the main point has to do with humility and pride. When someone is super arrogant, super prideful, and they stand up straight and their chin juts out and they walk around like they own the world and they're all puffed up, we look at them and we say they are full of... That guy is so full of himself. He's so full of himself. He thinks so much of himself. But someone who is humble doesn't walk around like that. They're not full of themselves. What have they done? They've emptied themselves. Of what? Themselves. They're not thinking about themselves. They're thinking about others. They're not living for themselves. They're living for others. As you read down through Philippians chapter 2, that whole section, what is Jesus doing? He's humbling himself and humbling himself and humbling himself and humbling himself. Why? Out of his love for others. To the point that he offers himself to death, a criminal's death, until God exalts him back up. The whole thing is about humility. It's about humility. Jesus rejected any advantage. You go to Matthew chapter 4, where he's led out into the wilderness and he's tempted by Satan multiple times. And the whole point there is he's offered multiple opportunities to give in to temporary pleasures, and he says no every single time. And that's not the only time he said no. Throughout his entire life, he said no to temporary pleasures, but it's one concentrated moment. Also from Philippians 2, he chose humiliation, just like Moses chose humiliation. He chose humiliation. Like it was humbling and humiliating for God to take on flesh. It was humbling to be born as a carpenter's son. It was humbling to die, but then to die death on a cross. He chose humiliation. And when you look at his time in the garden, especially in the Garden of Gethsemane, prior to his arrest and his crucifixion, and he's begging with God for any other way except the crucifixion, I'd suggest that he was scared and he was overwhelmed. But at the end, he submits himself to God's will and stands up and goes to meet Judas. He didn't let fear control him. Hebrews 12, 1 through 2, we looked at a lot at Hebrews 11 this morning, but Hebrews 12, it talks about how we're looking to Jesus, the author and founder of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross. Jesus endured. And Stephen's point in Acts chapter 7 is just like Moses tried to save the people but was rejected, Jesus came to deliver the people and was rejected. Moses points to Jesus. We're going to be talking about this all week long. Moses keeps pointing to Jesus. And what are some lessons? The first is this, that serving the Lord always begins with humility. Serving the Lord begins with humbling ourselves. It just does. Think about, and this was so helpful to me when this was pointed out, think about your conversion. Like, I understand spiritually what's going on with baptism, but there's something that I'd like to suggest. If you haven't thought about your conversion this way, I'd like to challenge you a little bit. And if you're thinking about conversion, then I want to challenge you a lot. Baptism is humbling. It's an act of submission. Like when people do incredible things in their lives, we celebrate, right? Somebody scores a touchdown in a football game and they spike that ball. And they had to put rules in place to keep them from over-celebrating. You'll get penalized if you do. But some guy's like, man, I was so macho and strong and fast and whoo, and he spikes the ball. And he celebrates. And the stadium goes crazy. And then you see other athletes do incredible things and they bump their chest and they're like, orangutans out there. Or someone does something really well with business and we give them some kind of award. Or we have some kind of show or some kind of event. They get some kind of medal. They get some kind of trophy. Do you realize that in baptism, there's none of that? You realize in baptism, you're dying. You realize in baptism, you're not doing anything. It's all being done to you. Somebody else is physically lowering your body into the water. You're not doing it. And you don't bring yourself up out of the water. Somebody else does it. And while you're in the water, God is doing something to you, not you, that you can't see. That's humbling. And for people that are afraid of water to boot, like I've seen somebody that needed to be baptized and they're terrified of water. And they did it. So if you want to serve the Lord, it begins with humility. And just like Moses and so many other people, your faith in God has to be greater than your fear of man. It's natural to have some of our fears, but don't let that fear control you. And don't let that fear be the determining factor in your decision. Verbalize it, share it, talk through it, but by faith, end up doing what God calls you to do. And what Moses and Jesus show us is that mistreatment with God's people is better than the temporary pleasures of sin. It doesn't mean fun and it doesn't mean easy, but it is better for you. And likewise, suffering with Jesus is better than any earthly treasure. We live in a country, we live in a culture that for right now, it is so much easier to be a Christian here in the U.S. than in so many other places in the world. It might not always be that way. Frankly, I think it's harder to be a Christian, honestly a Christian and a disciple in this country. It's harder now than it was 20, 30 years ago. And my suspicion is it's going to get increasingly more difficult. And we need to be preparing ourselves for that. It's not always going to be so easy to be a disciple and stand up and be known as a disciple or to say what a disciple ought to say. So be prepared that we may have to suffer more with Jesus than we used to. And maybe that's a good thing. And then finally, the way that Moses endured was by focusing on what is eternal and focusing on the one who is invisible. Jesus did the same, and we need to do likewise. If we're going to endure as a disciple, then we need to focus on God, and we need to focus on Christ and the promises that they've given us. You all have been super, super patient, and I've gone a few minutes over. Thank you for your patience. We'll have more time for each lesson, I think, on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday night. And as has been mentioned, that'll be at 7 o'clock. If you're not yet a Christian and you would like to humble yourself and become a Christian because of your faith in Christ and your desire to die with Him and be raised with Him, you can do that this morning. Or maybe you're a Christian and you've been letting the fears of this world dictate what you do. You're just not comfortable enough sacrificing and serving with Jesus. Let's get over that. Acknowledge the fear, but then choose faith. Whatever your need is, come to the front while we stand and while we sing.